Dr. Banner, now might be a really good time for you to get angry.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry.
A girl with a book in her hand, as she gracefully swung to and fro, was the dream of the men in the summer a very few seasons ago. The hammock gave way to lawn tennis, and then came a bike for a whirl. Like shadows in light, they all fade out of sight, giving place to the motor girl. She's a sprinter in the winter, through the spring and fall. In the summer, she's a hummer, holds the man in thrall. New love's meeting, pleasure fleeting, life's a merry whirl. For the daring, swerving, flashing, dashing motor girl.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Hello, we hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Carianis.
And I'm Owen Mugen.
And welcome back to the Angry History Show. The song you're hearing is from Broadway's 1909 musical comedy hit at the Lyric Theater, The Motor Girl. It's about Dorothy Dare, who wins an automobile race while disguised as her brother. That's my wife Kathy on the piano, and Val Hovick belting out the song about a new kind of modern woman, the motor girl. Val's a friend of ours, a singer-songwriter with some theater under his belt, so he was perfect belting out that over-the-top Broadway that they sang back at the turn of the century.
No, it's great. I really love it, too. I love the whole premise of this play, too. You know, she had to dress like her brother. It's like Lord of the Rings. It's like Eowyn, you know. She can only fight alongside the king dressed like a dude. But that's, you know, that's the way it was back then. You
know? Or when they did that stoning bit for saying Jehovah in Life of Brian. You know? Are there any women here? No. They're all fake. They're selling them fake beards and that kind of thing.
Exactly. But that's a great tune. I like it. Well done, Kathy and Val.
Today we're stepping through the Guardian of Forever to meet a pioneer. Her name was Alice Hewler Ramsey, and at just 22 years old, she set out to do something no women had ever done before, drive across America.
Yep. It was 105 years ago last June that Alice, who's a housewife from Hackensack, New Jersey, made this unprecedented trek. She was 5 foot nothing, as the saying goes, and had dropped out of Vassar to get married. Her husband was president of the Hackensack Brick Company, lawyer John Rathbone Ramsey. Alice was called him Bone for short.
And I haven't asked you this before, but I'm just going to picture DeForest Kelly as her husband. Because Bones, not? Star Trek's Bones. Can you imagine having him represent you in Congress? How awesome that would be. You think that James Stewart was mad as Mr. Smith goes to Washington? You put DeForest Kelly in Congress. Oh, gosh.
That's
can we bring him back, please?
I'm a doctor, not a filibusterer.
And speaking of TV, as we often do, you remember the show Alice, of course, that ran from 1976 to 1985. Yeah. It had Linda Lavin in the title role and Vic Tayback, Star Trek's Jojo Krakow.
Vic Tayback.
Along for a piece of the action. Huh? Yep. Get it?
Yeah, well, I see what you did there.
The sitcom gave us Alice Hyatt, setting out from New Jersey on a cross-country ride, much like Alice Hewler Ramsey.
Early to rise, early to bed, and in between I cooked and cleaned and went out of my head. Going through life with blinders on, it's tough to see. I had to get up, get out from and look for me. There's a new girl in town, and she's looking good. There's a fresh freckle face in the neighborhood. There's a new girl in town with a bra-
You like that little bit of synergy, don't you?
I did like it.
Man, that's so funny. I hadn't heard that song in a while. I used to watch it. I definitely watched Alice, you know, Polly Holiday, and who played Vera? What the heck was her name? She was actually awesome in a Sondheim musical called Company. Great documentary called Company by Pennebaker. You should watch it. On TV, losing her husband sparked Alice Height to hit the road, and it was also a brush with death that sparked our Alice. So she was riding on horseback, right, when what she described as a monster, a Pierce Arrow automobile, spooked her mount, causing it to bolt. Unnerved by nearly losing his wife, Bone decided to buy her one of those newfangled automobiles, too. And Alice loved it, and she racked up like 6,000 miles on the unpaved roads of Hackensack in that first summer.
I looked at a lot of those pictures of those days, and you can't imagine 6,000 miles on such really primitive roads. That must have been what she did most of her time. I don't know how she had any time in there to be a mother and a wife and everything else, but she really loved to drive. And one reason I wanted to do this episode is Hackensack is the county seat of Bergen County, where I was born and grew up. So there's a lot of local history for me, a lot of these historic plaques that I've driven by and walked by and rid my little Schwinn Stingray by all my life.
Right.
It brings them to life, which is something that we love to do, of course.
There's one marking the site where Captain John Hewler, Alice's ancestor, had his farm after serving in the Revolution, and one for the Hewler's Landing Road. That was a crude colonial route that British General Cornwallis used to attack Fort Lee in 1776.
And Bone, for instance, John Ramsey, are you picturing DeForest Kelly?
I'm trying. I'm trying. I just keep getting.
I see what he really looks like. It's not nearly as good. Trust me.
No, but it's like, but it's the difference between bone and bones. And I just, you know, I'm a literalist. I'm just having a hard time. But go ahead.
Okay, John Ramsey represented the district in Congress and was related to Peter J. Ramsey, who the town of Ramsey, New Jersey, is named after.
Ah. That's good. And see, of course, I wanted to do this episode because Miss Tessmacher's mom is from Hackensack.
Miss Tessmacher!
But you really enjoyed researching this one because it has links to a bunch of, you know, the historical things that you love, you know, in Crestville, New Jersey. It's funny, you hear these words, these town names so often, Fort Lee. You know why? Because there was a fort there, Fort Greene, where I'm from. There was a fort there. These are more than just names of places that have sort of, you know, they actually represented, especially, you know, Fort Lee, Fort Greene. These were Revolutionary War hotspots. I mean, this is where it all happened, where Dean and I grew up, so we kind of love it. But anyway, I'm rambling. I'm rambling. We're back. I'm rambling.
And Fort Lee, in fact, right on the other side, the New Jersey side of the George Washington Bridge, you can go to the Colonial Park there, Revolutionary Era Park, and see they have a lot of little houses there, if you can even call them that, you know, little log cabin type things. And that's where Washington stood and watched as the British took Manhattan. On the other side, Fort Washington, which is the other side of the bridge where that lands. Yep. So you could still see a lot of this Revolutionary Era history there. And that's something that I like to do is you try to look back and think. I mean, there's a lot of highways, obviously, in, you know, New York and New Jersey. This is a built-up area. But a lot of that is really preserved for us to go and enjoy today. And there's nothing like standing in the spot where Washington stood.
No, absolutely. And the thing you have to remember when you try to picture where General Washington stood is no matter what your height you are, General Washington in real life, he was about 300 feet tall. And so try to just, you know, work that into you know, you're reenacting it in your mind.
And at a time when the average height was only 100 feet tall, the average revolutionary soldier. So that gives you some idea.
This is like we're turning this whole into the Old Testament. Noah was 700 years old and his wife was a youthful 500. But sorry, go ahead.
Another plaque is outside the Benjamin P. Westervelt house, which was right at the end of the street where I grew up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Westervelt served in the local militia during the Revolution also, and he built the house 25 years after independence. What does that have to do with Alice Hewler Ramsey, you may ask? Go ahead and ask.
What does that have to do with Alice Hewler Ramsey?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Her great-great-grandfather...
This is what I do. I ask.
Jonas W. Hewler married the girl down the street from Captain Hewler's farm that we just talked about in 1805, and her name was Effie Westervelt. So Alice Ramsey is coming from these two really prominent Revolutionary War families.
Any of these people related to the Tessmachers? We'll get back to that. I'm sure we'll figure that out at some point. But so back in modern times, Alice is modern times anyway. It's you know, nigh on 106 years for us at this point. Her new toy was this top of the line in 1909, same year the Motor Girl play captured the popular imagination. The car was this fire engine red with matching tufted leather seats, and what passed for the open road, it reached what Alice called, quote, the terrific speed of 42 miles per hour.
Yeah, really fast. And that was on the best roads. That was the best speed you could do.
But that's insanely fast when you, if you're looking at what came before.
Yeah, and it was a risk.
Right.
I rode in a Humvee just sort of on top of it, one of those that they have in Las Vegas. And I said, man, if this thing goes over, you're not wearing a seatbelt up there. Really, you don't realize how fast you're going. And just try sticking your head out the window when you're driving on a major highway and just think about getting that in your face. And
Right. That's
what these cars offered. They offered speed, if not comfort, and really were a status symbol. The Maxwell Briscoe Motor Company of Indiana cranked them out from 1904 until 1923, when Walter P. Chrysler absorbed the company. The 1925 Maxwell will be the last, giving way to the Plymouth. It was an iconic car in its day, the Maxwell, but mm-hmm. by the time Jack Benny hit it big, the Maxwell would have been as outdated as a 70s station wagon with wood paneling is today.
We had one of those.
Sure, didn't everybody?
Yep, it seemed like it, right? I mean, I love the wood paneling. It's like, here, this car is sort of like your rec room. Enjoy it. But anyway, here's Jack Benny doing a bit on his Maxwell with the help on sound effects from Mel Blanc, man of a thousand voices, including our pal Bugs Bunny and, of course, Biggie, 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 Biggie. Hey, Buck.
Tweaky.
Tweaky. Go ahead, hit it.
Can you remember the day you bought your first automobile? I can remember driving mine home, for I had my friend Mel Blanc with me. Mel and I still work together, and I still have the Maxwell.
By the way, neither the Maxwell Company nor Alice were trying to make some kind of suffragette statement. The idea was to show that the Maxwell was so easy to drive, even a woman could do it. Isn't that nice? Not at all condescending.
No. And newspapers savaged the stunt as dangerous, ridiculous, and, quote, beyond the capabilities of women drivers. It's sort of like driving in Saudi Arabia today. New York Times denounced them as trying to do a man's job. And Alice later wrote, quote, "This criticism, of course, merely whetted the appetites of those who were convinced that we could drive as well as most men," end quote. Of driving cross-country, she said, "It's been done by men, and as long as they've been able to accomplish it, why shouldn't I?" Quote. Now, keep in mind, like, this is 11 years before women got the vote, so this attitude really shouldn't surprise anyone. It's funny, you know, whenever I think of transcontinental races and cross-country driving, you know, I think of Cannonball Run, obviously, but I also think of the awesome 1975 movie Death Race 2000, and here is the incredible Junior Bruce announcing the arrival of the circuit's top racer. Give a listen.
Frankenstein! Frankenstein the legend! Frankenstein the indestructible! Sole survivor of the Titanic pileup of 95! Only two-time winner of the Transcontinental Road Race! Frankenstein! Ripped up, wiped out, battered, shattered, creamed and reamed! A dancer on the brink of death! Frankenstein, who lost a leg in 98, an arm in 99, with half a face and half a chest and all the guts in the world, he's back. God only knows what he looks like under that mask, but he is back. In the name of Mr. President, America loves you, Frankenstein.
I'm sorry, I can't help it. I love that shot. I just love it. It's been playing in my brain for years, trapped in there. My buddy Lee Elliott turned me on to that movie, and I can't stop thinking about it. So here you go. Enjoy the infection. It's in your head now, too.
I wouldn't think of that as a theater movie, but I guess it was. But I'm sure that there was a version of it that was just on the television set.
Sylvester Stallone is in it. Martin Cove, who you probably best remember as the bad sensei from Karate Kid. You know, a bunch of people you recognize in it. It's a real David Carradine played Frankenstein. And and it was so definitely I had impressions of the film, but that great Junior Bruce thing was something I hadn't remembered. But yeah, it was early Sly. It was Sly like, you know, a year before Rocky. And so it's a great twisted, subversive film. Look it up.
And there was
now. Look it up. We'll wait. Go ahead.
Stop driving, people. We know you're driving listeners. Pull over.
Exactly. By the way, hopefully if you're in traffic, and we talked about this before, we talk about this offline, if you guys are in traffic driving, and traffic to me, we're talking about cars and all that, and we'll talk a bit about L.A. and she got out there and how it's just car culture in general. It's so sort of alien to my way of thinking, being a city kid who didn't have a car, you know, until I was 36. But hopefully if we're with you, and it's traffic and it sucks, you know, just know that we're thinking about you guys, and get home safely. Seriously.
Yeah. And you can roll down the window, just start blasting us to other people, because I would really, you know, I'd really just start demanding that they learn things about history. Well, don't you want to hear about the Slocum? You people know nothing. This woman is driving. This is the first woman to ever do this. We must hear all about her.
It's important.
Yeah. And death race. There was deaths in the movies, but there was death back then just to drive across, to drive a car, to drive a horse. Obviously, she almost died.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's what we call a segue in the business. Listen, he'll continue.
You can't even see the strings, my friend. You can't even see the strings. But the thing is, driving a car really was risky business in 1909 for anybody, men or women. The first man had only traveled across country a short time before Alice, keep in mind.
Right.
So there's no power brakes, no power steering, no power anything. Certainly no airbags or seatbelts.
Ralph Nader would not have been down with these early cars at all.
No windshield wiper, heck, no windows, a canvas top, side curtains, and celluloid windshield. And you'd actually roll up your windshield. I don't know if anybody sees those old cars anymore, but next time you see one, it's all yellowed now, usually kind of cracked with age if they haven't replaced it, needless to say. But you just roll that sucker up when you felt like it when you took the hood off. There was also this canvas top that you would remove. And also, they're making the trip in the summer. They set out in June, so there's no air conditioning in the car. Needless to say, there's no air conditioning anywhere in the world. And the tires, simple canvas tubes coated in rubber without any treads for traction. Forget all those ads you see. You know, Mitchell, and there's so much riding on your tires.
Right.
Ramsey sends his wife out there to drive across the country with no treads even on it.
I had a feeling he didn't send anything. She was going one way or the other.
Well, I wonder how much of a hard time people gave him. You know, they either were teasing him probably, or they were saying, how dare you do this? Now my wife wants a car.
Well, right. It's like Al Neary walking over to Fredo. You know, if you can't take care of this, I have to.
Yeah.
And his wife is out of control. I don't think he had a choice. She had a lust for the road, and man, she went for it. And I love that she took her sisters-in-law with her.
Yeah, those were his only stipulation. Because if you're going to be out there risking death, you don't want to die alone, do you?
No.
So I'd rather my whole family go.
Leave that to Kirk.
Yeah. And speaking of those tires, they blew out a dozen times. And although there were men in a pilot car leading the way, Alice changed all the tires herself, never surrendered the wheel. She did all the driving. People would tell her, just ship the car. This is too crazy. You can't pass these roads. So it really required her to forge ahead. And like you said, she really wanted to get to San Francisco.
Yep. Check this out. Here's an Angry History reading of a piece that Alice wrote for Family Weekly magazine in September of 1964, a half century after her slog from Kitchen and Hackensack to good old San Francisco. Give it a listen.
I was 21 and found driving easy. I did so well in a 150-mile endurance run from New York City to Montauk Point, Long Island, that my driving caught the eye of Carl Kelsey, sales manager of the Maxwell Briscoe Motor Company. Mr. Kelsey had sold cars through many kinds of publicity stunts. You are going to be the first woman to drive an automobile across the United States, he told me that evening in Montauk Point. If I would ever make the effort, he would give me a new 1909 Maxwell, supply gasoline, oil, and spare parts, and pay all my expenses. I had a good nurse taking care of my small son and was eager to try. Only a dozen men, most of them professional drivers, had then motored from coast to coast. A woman and two girls had been along, but only as passengers in 1908, when the Jacob Murdochs of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, became the first family to cross the continent by automobile. Paved highways, filling stations, and road maps were still in the future. My husband, who never learned to drive, was agreeable to the idea. The Murdochs had made it from Pasadena to New York in 32 days without driving on Sundays. I shouldn't be away from home much longer. My husband asked only that I take along his two sisters as companions and chaperones. They were Mrs. Nettie Powell and Mrs. William Atwood, both in their 40s. I added a fourth passenger, Miss Hermione Yonds, younger than any of us and also from Hackensack. She had been my mechanician on an all-woman run to Philadelphia.
With her team set, Alice was ready to hit the road. The starting line was a Maxwell dealership up where Lincoln Center and the Metropolitan Opera are today. Fittingly, the trip started on a Manhattan island without any automotive bridges or tunnels across the Hudson River.
We started in a pouring rain from Broadway in New York on June 9, 1909, a Wednesday. Our car was a four-cylinder Maxwell 30, so-called for its 30 horsepower. Except for a 20-gallon instead of a 14-gallon gasoline tank, it was a standard touring car that sold for $1,750. It had a right-hand drive, but because of the bulb of the honk-honk horn and extra spare tires on that side, I had to get in from the left. The fuel tank was under the front seat.
Wait a minute.
And there was no gauge.
Wait a minute. I have to stop it there. She's sitting on a 20-gallon tank of gasoline for this entire extremely bumpy, super dangerous ride. Can you imagine? Speaking of Ralph Nader, you can't even carry a gas can in your car anymore.
No.
Meanwhile, I don't figure it was well sealed either, so you'd have fumes and everything that goes with it. And that really took some guts.
Now it does. And it reminds me of that amazing Clouseau film, Wages of Fear. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's like these dead-enders who are in this sort of nondescript Central American country, and there's no work. You know, you sort of like a few Americans, and they get trapped there, and there's nothing else to do except eventually turn to the local oil company and drive these trucks filled with nitroglycerin across unpaved roads, to the blasting site. And it's basically just, who comes undone, who gets unmanned, as they say, just by the sheer pressure. This reminds me of that. I mean, so you're in constant danger doing this thing. Can you imagine old Bone, too? Yeah, sure, honey, go ahead. Just take my sisters along, too, so you don't potentially get engulfed in flames by yourself, okay? We want this to be a family immolation event if it does happen. So there's absolutely no safety at this point. There's not a freaking fuel gauge, for the love of God. So we need to hear what Alice used to check the gas level. All right, let's just listen to this. This is great.
The fuel tank was under the front seat, and there was no gauge. We measured the gasoline with a ruled stick. The engine, of course, had to be started by cranking. I cranked it, and the motor roared. I gave my husband a farewell kiss and clambered into the car. With chains on the rear wheels, because of the rain, we clanked up Broadway. Heading towards upstate New York, we stopped in Tarrytown, where the Maxwell was made, to pose for photographers and to eat lunch. The road was freshly oiled and slippery. After 76 miles, we were happy to stop for the night at the old Homie Nelson House in Poughkeepsie. I had pleasant memories of both, as I had attended Vassar College in that city. It was still raining the next day, but again we donned our rubber ponchos and pushed on. Nettie held an open blue book on her lap and advised me of landmarks ahead. The blue books were forerunners of highway road maps and had directions like, turn right at Red Barn. But if the owner painted his barn another color after the book went to press, you could go astray. We had lunch with Maxwell men in Albany, replaced a worn tire, and pushed westward. Rain still fell. After slightly more than 100 miles, we called it a day at Amsterdam. The next day was sunny. We had a good lunch at the Hotel Martin in Utica and stopped for the night in Auburn. The warden showed us through the state prison there the next morning, and when we came out, the car wouldn't start, despite my cranking. While a coil was being brought from Syracuse, we were towed back to the hotel, and somebody shouted, "Get a horse!" But we got off at 5:30 p.m. and found the going so good that we continued after dark all the 138 miles to Buffalo, arriving at 1:15 a.m.
And do you pick your feet in Poughkeepsie? Sorry, it's my second Gene Hackman reference. I had to, whenever I hear Poughkeepsie, I think of French Connection. So Alice and her passengers have 2 days under their belts, right? And her average speed per 24 hours is less than a modern car would go in a minute. They're exhausted when they pull into town in the middle of the night. No electric bulbs in the Maxwell, or streets, actually, to help them find their way. Carbide gas driving lamps and kerosene lanterns on the dash provided the only illumination.
Yeah, and if you're wondering why they'd make a stop at Auburn State Prison, I have a small guess. They'd...
Gee, go ahead. I wonder what that could possibly be.
What is Auburn State Prison in my era and in that era famous for or infamous for is just a few years before they'd executed Leon Czolgosz for assassinating President William McKinley in 1901. And so this is actually McKinley's birthday weekend here. So This is something that I thought maybe this is why they decided to stop in, and you can't visit his grave or anything. They just dissolved Czolgosz in sulfuric acid. People were they get kind of a little spiteful, forget carefully washing bin Laden and giving him a nice burial. If you were Benedict Arnold or you shot a president, they were going to just erase you like Booth. In fact, some of the Abraham Lincoln writings in one of Booth's letters, John Wilkes Booth, just sold in an auction for a huge amount of money. And they said because anything with Booth's name on it, they just started burning and throwing away and, smashing all the playbills from the theater or whatever they had. And they just did not want to. They want to erase you from history, as we talked about with Benedict Arnold. They were not forgiving, and they didn't want to preserve it for history. They just were ashamed of you. So you were shunned from the pages.
I wonder how many productions of Our American Cousin have been mounted since the assassination. I guess people still must do the play, but I don't know.
We'll have to look into that maybe and go back to it. That is a fascinating question to see what people... Because I remember it wasn't a fabulous play, really, at the time. So.
Right. And what happened in the third act was awful and hard to reproduce. But
I think they've mounted it at Ford Theater, certainly. But
I would imagine so. Yeah. It was an odd thought that struck me.
It might have seemed like a landmark at the time in the decades before the world's largest ball of string and other roadside attractions. When you think about it, they wanted to see something along the way. Come see the prison.
Yes.
But, they want to sit in the chair? Just kidding.
Exactly. Sorry, ladies.
Yes, the first presidential assassin electrocuted. Hoo-ah.
But that's right.
In any case, there were still natural wonders to see along the way, and they did just that.
And wasn't there the 8,000-foot-tall George Washington cradle that he slept in as a baby? But anyway, go ahead.
I think you're thinking of Finn McCool.
That's who it is. Yeah. I'm always thinking of Finn McCool. Okay, we're going to toss to this side. Here comes a soundbite.
After a weekend of entertainment that included a drive to Niagara Falls, we turned west along Lake Erie. Driving 198 miles through Erie, Pennsylvania, and Ashtabula and Painesville in Idaho, we made Cleveland for the night. We hit 42 miles an hour on the Cleveland Parkway, our top speed. After a stop for lunch in Lorain, Ohio, we had a blowout and got stuck in a piece of bad road, but made Toledo the next night. Despite the rain, we were in Chicago 2 weeks after our start and added a tow rope, a block and tackle, and a shovel to our equipment. We needed all of these to struggle across Iowa. At times, we had to camp and wait for the mud to dry. To my embarrassment, we once ran out of gasoline. Roads were so bad that we couldn't go to Omaha as planned, but had to turn northwest. The rear axle failed and had to be replaced. We spent 13 days getting across Iowa's 360 miles of gumbo and reached Sioux City on July 2nd. Between there and Columbus, Nebraska, we twice had to pay farmers to pull us out of mud holes. To get up one hill, my passengers had to get out and ride up by wagon. 4 miles from Grand Island, Nebraska, the right half of the rear axle broke and a farm family took us in while a mechanic brought a replacement from Denver. Nettie hadn't been feeling well and was happy to give her place to the mechanic and ride the train ahead to Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Gee, Nettie started feeling sick? I can't imagine. Oh, you don't say. Could it be the gasoline fumes you've been breathing since New Jersey?
Yeah, or maybe just those terribly not aerodynamic hats. And I think, if you look at the pictures, if they didn't have those hats on, they probably really could have squeezed out maybe 45, 46 miles an hour. But those hats were not going to help. So, and this is the problem, though, with this leaking. Without having a gas gauge, if you forget to check, you can run out. We're so spoiled behind the wheel these days. Plus the car is breaking down. There are no mechanics, no spare parts. The simple technology, though, meant that they could repair a lot of breakdowns themselves, even just by going to a horse farrier where they could, heat and bend the axle back into shape. It was real, there was no choice. There was no AAA. You're not going to, get on your smartphone and have AAA show up. This was straight up DIY. This was sheer adventurism. Awesome.
On two occasions, that rear axle that you talked about snapped. The roads were impassable at times. And again, these are not roads, really. They're just dirt and mud, and you know, people throw things across the road and
dry riverbeds,
tree branches. You know? They sit there, yeah,
exactly.
And they often had to double back, but the Maxwell forded creeks up to 12 feet wide and 4 feet deep. Alice would just hike up her dress, walk out there, and see. If she didn't get swept away, I guess she would know right. They could pass it.
Like the Nazgul.
And they even crossed the Rocky Mountains, of course, when you think about the map of the U.S. When the radiator ran low at one point, the women used their toiletry jars to refill it, little pretty silver caps on them, and go down to the river, bring it back slowly. They weren't about to do a Red Dawn thing, I guess, and refill the radiator that way.
Right.
And more than once, they helped other drivers and men out of jams, which must have been very gratifying considering all that bad press they'd gotten.
Right. And at the auto races in Crown Point, Indiana, they had a fender bender with a speeding Cadoo, or they could have if the Maxwell had anything like we consider fenders, which it didn't. In Iowa, the motor started skipping, and Alice had to take a hammer to the spark plug, which you could disassemble in those days, actually. In Salt Lake City, she scraped carbon out of the cylinder heads, and once she even overhauled the Magneto. Man, if Magneto were along, she'd have no trouble straightening out that axle. It'd be pretty awesome. Can you imagine?
Yeah, that would have been really handy. Not worry about fording the river. You just lift your car.
And you know what? And I think had that happened, we would not be remembering Alice or her companions. We'd be remembering the guy who could lift cars over rivers. So good thing he wasn't there.
I guess so. You know, but yet another example of when mutant powers really would come in.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's too bad. Yeah. In Nebraska, police detained them for questioning about a murderer on the loose. In Opal, Wyoming, at a hotel, the woman picked up a horrible case of bed bugs, as they described it. And in the wild west of Nevada, they had what Alice called the only real scare of her trip. They saw a bunch of Native Americans on horseback, armed with bows and arrows. They didn't know what to make of this when they saw them coming, but they were just a hunting party out looking for jackrabbits.
Right, right. Those farmers were great guys, too, huh? Charging them for help. I mean, there's this real animosity toward motorists at this point, you know, and imagine, you know, painting your barn just to stick it to strangers. I mean, that's sort of the attitude here. But that's just one guy did, because as a neighbor told Alice, he was, quote, again, the automobile. And other people just, you know, put railroad ties across the street to screw with cars and yelling at people, get a horse. The worst we ever did as kids, we would take spools of thread and just go back and forth and line the street with them. And we lived on a small block in East Flatbush. So nothing would happen beyond just, you know, people going, what's going on here? You know, break the occasional antenna. But we were not into clotheslining or, you know, chopping people's heads off.
Yeah, well, that's what this was. I mean, that's not just mischief, a railroad tie. Again, we said no lights on these cars.
So
you're driving it down maybe at 42 miles an hour or something, and there's a railroad tie in the street. There's no windshield to go through. I guess that's one positive. But you're not getting up, brushing yourself off, and walking away from that. That's a really dangerous thing that people were doing. But they were that hostile. And that thing shouting, get a horse, that wasn't one guy. That was a common epithet, like if you shouted at somebody wearing a New York Jets jersey, get a quarterback.
Go Iowa.
Flash Gordon, quarterback, New York Jets.
Nobody does that, but it might help. I mean, certainly nothing could hurt the Jets.
Right.
And you'd only have those landmarks, even like the barn, to look for if they had blue books, which they didn't have many of.
No.
Once they got past a certain point. No GPS, no gas stations, no road maps, barely any roads. There'd be that mud. That's what Alice describes as gumbo.
Yeah.
And this was still the frontier. Wyoming had only been admitted as a state to the Union 19 years before 1909.
Yep.
Alice never wrote down how she found gasoline, but again, no filling stations. They said you'd go into a hardware store and just hope that they had a nice barrel of gasoline hanging around, and you could fill up your little death trap tank and be on your way, honk, honk.
Girls, hold on to your boyfriends.
She could only do it once. What did she do for an encore? Yeah.
Thank you. You complete me, Batman.
There were as yet no blue books for the West, so the Maxwell people had pilot cars guide us across Wyoming. As the highway bridge across the Platte River had been washed out, I had to bump the car 3/4 of a mile across the railroad trestle of the Union Pacific. A new Pierce Arrow, being driven home by former Mayor Ezra Thompson of Salt Lake City, gallantly led us into Utah. With a guide, we drove southwest out of Salt Lake City, following two tracks through the sagebrush. Suddenly, we hit a prairie dog hole with such force that the bolt came out of the tie rod connecting the front wheels. They collapsed and the front end sank to the ground. Fortunately, there was a forge at Orr's Ranch, and repairs were made. We had a similar breakdown the next day. My passengers went ahead to Ely, Nevada, while another blacksmith repaired a spring. I picked them up there. In spite of everything, we made it across Nevada and arrived near midnight at the Riverside Hotel in Reno. Through gorgeous scenery, we continued by way of Placerville, Sacramento, and Stockton, California. There, a parade of Maxwells from San Francisco met us and led us to the Oakland Ferry. In San Francisco, flowers, honking horns, and mail from Hackensack awaited us. The date was August 7th. We had been almost 2 months coming 3,800 miles, but because of various mishaps, had driven only 41 days.
41 days. That's actually about how long it takes to cross L.A. during rush hour. That's kind of where we're at now. So upon arrival at the St. James Hotel, Alice and her companions were swarmed by photographers and press guys. It must have been like Charles Lindbergh landing in Paris. What a day, Alice wrote. But for that matter, what a journey. A prelude to the thousands of women drivers who would later make the same trip, end quote.
And what a great sentiment. Of course, we love people who are looking forward in history as well as back.
Right.
If you're a woman right now driving across the country, you have a link to this woman. And we all have hard times. I haven't driven across the country. We always talk about doing it, you and I.
Well, you and I will be getting to that probably sooner rather than later.
And it's nice to have that sort of link. And it makes you feel a little bit humbled that here you have all this comfort and your little seat warmer, keep your tushy warm, and you know, your radio. Oh, there's nothing on the radio. Or let me just turn down the AC a wee. I mean, these are people that really were pioneers in the very earliest days of cross-country travel.
It's so funny about the keeping warm and driving with a heated seat in the car. I'd never really experienced that before. We were driving to the Lincoln Memorial over Christmas with my sister-in-law, and she's got a nice big car. She got a fancy automobile, and all of a sudden I'm like, am I getting ill? I don't feel right. Something's wrong with my lower back and my butt and my legs. And she's like, oh yeah, no, we have a heater in here. I'm like, great, spoiled. First world problems. It's nice.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't know what to do. My butt was warm. You know what it meant to Alice Hewler-Ramsey if her butt was warm? It meant the gas tank was about to explode.
Yeah. It means that she was on fire.
And after she went through this incredible journey and overcame all these hardships, the San Francisco Chronicle reported the next day, headline, Pretty Woman Motorists Arrive After Trip Across the Continent. The trip across the continent was made largely for pleasure. Oh, yes, the bedbugs sounded particularly enjoyable.
Yes.
And to see the country, and the exclusion of men was largely just to show that they are not at all necessary.
Nice to have you back, Chappie.
Thank
nice
you. Yeah, you well, you know, I was reading a story about that the other day, and they talked about how because of the primitive recording technology, and that made me think of us, that you can, that really helped to get it. That's why in the old movies they spoke in that clip, they called it mid-Atlantic accent.
Yes.
Nobody really actually speaks like that in the world, but they would use it back then because it just recorded better. So don't you find yourself listening better when I do that?
I do.
Leaning in?
I lean in. I just like the showmanship.
Oh, yeah, sure. I used to be a big top carnival barker back in the 1880s.
Exactly.
Alice told reporters, quote, as it was, a number of cars driven by men either turned back or were shipped ahead on flat cars, but I stuck to the wheel and got through.
Quote, women can handle an automobile just as well as men. You should have seen us get the machine out of an irrigation ditch in Wyoming. We just took out the block and tackle, hooked it up to a stump, and pulled the machine out. End quote. They were hailed as heroes from coast to coast, but they had to be exhausted. So after a day in Los Angeles, Alice hopped a train back to Bone and her son. A decade later, Alice drove across country again in an overland and made the trip just about every year except during World War II.
Once she did it with what turned out to be a fractured elbow. She'd fallen and she didn't realize that she'd broken it until she got x-rays when she reached her destination. When she discovered the fact, Alice said, transcontinental driving is now so easy that you can even do it with a broken arm. And incredibly, she only received a single ticket in all of her years of driving, and it was for an illegal U-turn.
Well, you kind of laugh at that notion, but there was, I'm sure there was no power steering fluid, you know, there was no power steering.
That's
you
true.
You had to really be able to.
Gosh.
Anyway, in 1960, the Automobile Manufacturers Association christened Alice the First Lady of Automotive Travel, end quote, and AAA named her Woman Motorist of the Century. A year later, she published a memoir of the trip titled Veil, Duster, and Tire Iron. She kept driving as long as she could, only giving up on completing the sixth pass of the Swiss Alps after a doctor's warning that her pacemaker could give out.
Yeah, she only did the first five. Oh, she's really losing her edge.
Really,
there,
way
guess,
to go.
But, and if you find yourself in Reno, perhaps you're shooting a man just to watch him die.
As we do.
Check out the House of Blends Coffee House. you'll see a mural painted by John Tun, or Ton, it's T-O-N, commemorating Alice's cross-country journey. It looks really nice. If you see the pictures online, we'll throw one up at angryhistory.com or at our Facebook page.
Alice Ramsey died in 1983 at 95, but her legend drives on. In 2000, she became the first woman inducted into the Automotive Hall of Fame. And to mark the centennial of the trip, in 2009, Richard Anderson and his daughter Emily drove cross-country in a Maxwell that Richard rebuilt. No signal lights, no seat belts, no radio or fuel gauge. They were arrested and they are awaiting sentencing right now. Just like Alice, although the roads were considerably better, Alice's trip covered 3,600 miles, of which only 152 were paved. That is nuts.
Really, think about that. And the thing about never getting a ticket either, the police weren't looking to write tickets in those days. They didn't have radar guns. And
they weren't being used as revenue agents.
Yes, exactly what I was thinking. Because the thing is, this father and daughter, the Andersons, who decided to just test the car to drive it. They were in a parking lot, I believe, just getting ready to go, and a cop zoomed in there and said, "Wait, there's no mirrors on this vehicle." Sorry, I started thinking of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Great scene with John Candy. They get pulled over, the car's smoldering.
No. Now you got no outside mirror.
No, we lost that.
You have no functioning gauges.
No, not a one. However, the radio still works. Funny as that may seem, with all this mess, that the radio is the only thing that's really working good, and it's as clear as a bell. Don't ask me how.
We'll leave you with one last clip. It's from Dwight D. Eisenhower speaking in Detroit's Cadillac Square on October 29th, 1954. You've probably seen the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System signs if you've done any amount of driving. They're blue with the five stars of Ike's rank from World War II. It was his vision that helped turn a trip across the country in an automobile from a dangerous feat that took months to a commonplace occurrence.
Yep. And hey, listen, a quick shout out to the great Joe Franklin. He's a broadcast legend who died last night, January 25th. Franklin was 88 years old. If you don't know him, Google away. A rare bird, Joe Franklin. Rest in peace, Joe. Thank you for all the awesome, awesome, awesome interviews.
I did not know that until this very moment.
Yeah.
Joe Franklin, friends, this was one of his ways to address people. And he had a restaurant not far from Port Authority. Mm-hmm. Was that on 8th and about maybe 46th? And you'd see him there all the time. He was just a really friendly guy and a broadcast pioneer, much as Alice was a pioneer in driving. And that's too bad. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Joe Franklin, rest in peace.
Absolutely. Just wanted to give him a little love on the way out.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and everybody, a very cordial welcome to our Joe Franklin TV show every day for 90 minutes. We have open house. We chit-chat. We try and keep it informal and relaxed, and it's fun.
And here's Dwight David Eisenhower talking about the legacy that he has, which is the highways we drive today. I'm Dean Karyanis.
I'm Owen Mugen. We will see you next time, beep, beep, on the Angry History Show. Take care, guys.
This is the greatest construction program in the entire history of the nation. There has been an expanded program. A regular program of road construction has been expanded and made bigger than ever before. We are pushing ahead with a great road program. A road program that will take this nation out of its antiquated shackles of secondary roads all over this country and give us places, give us the types of highways that we need for this great mass of voters. It will be a nation of great prosperity, but it will be more than that. It will be a nation that's going ahead every day, with Americans being born to us, with our population increasing at 5 every minute. The expanding horizon is one that staggers the imagination.
Swung to and fro was the dream of the men in the summer a very few seasons ago. The hammock gave way to lawn tennis, and then came the bike for a whirl. Like shadows in light, they all fade out of sight, giving place to the motor girl. She's a sprinter in the winter, through the spring and fall. In the summer, she's a hummer, holds the man in thrall. New love's meeting, pleasure fleeting, life's a flashing, dashing motor girl. She's a sprinter in the winter, through the spring and fall. In the summer, she's a hummer, holds the man in thrall. New love's meeting, pleasure fleeting, life's a merry world. For the daring, scaring, flashing, dashing motor girl. Our grandmother sat weaving laces, tapestry frames. Imagine the look on their faces had they witnessed our up-to-date games. Girls yachting, girls wheeling, girls rowing, or bathing where high breakers curl. And to crown all of these, watch a 40-mile breeze kiss the cheeks of a motor girl. She's a sprinter in the winter, through the spring and fall. In the summer, she's a hummer, holds the man in thrall. New love's meeting, pleasure fleeting, life's a merry world. For the daring, scaring, flashing, dashing motor girl.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.